Hello, I'm Keith Perron, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. The chair of Transparency International in Papua New Guinea says there's always been a feeling that university student leaders could cop the blame for disturbances on campuses. The comment from Lauren Stevens comes as student leaders at the University of PNG in Port Moresby were told they were permanently terminated from all courses as the academic year resumes this week. UPNG students were suspended in July after a series of disruptions at the Waganami campus amid six-week boycott of classes by students in protest against their demand that Prime Minister Peter O'Neill stand aside to face fraud allegations. Mr. Stevens told Johnny Blades that the Student Representative Council had conducted its boycott peacefully before police moved in to open fire on students on campus in June, which brought everything to a head.
It seemed to me to be peaceful and to be well organized. And I actually wandered into the SRC office and was sitting there chatting to one of the people when in walked a former president of the SRC and spoke to the current president and said, one of the things you need to be very careful of is the people trying to cause trouble to destroy what you're trying to do. And that, I think, was the fear we all had, that there would be elements who would like to cause trouble, and this would be blamed on the student leaders.
It's an emotive set of circumstances, isn't it? Because obviously some of the people who were in the students' firing line for their criticisms were almost discrediting the students as being children or misleading the hopes of their villages and families. So it all becomes very emotive, didn't it? They were trying just to have a very frank discussion in public, though, weren't they?
It appeared from what I saw in the students and from my discussions with a couple of them, it appeared to be very sensible and very important stuff that they were talking about. And it really is shameful when people use this faulty logic and argue that the reason that you are thinking this way is because you're young or because you're from a certain part of the country. It's just insulting and wrong. And I suppose provocative to some people who simply get fed up with the reality that there are individuals who appear to have the highest levels of impunity, unimaginable levels of impunity, whereas a bunch of students asking for a bit of honesty can be suspended and even terminated.
At times during the boycotts, some of the government said, why should the student population be held ransom to just a few elements? And what right do these elements have to demand that the head of the government stand down? I mean, maybe they had a point. I mean, it takes some nerve, doesn't it, to sort of just suddenly demand someone step down?
Personally, I felt that that was not the correct approach. I could see that what the students were looking for was an answer to do with all the money that's been stolen. The inactivity when it comes to investigating very criminal actions that have happened in Papua New Guinea, the particular focus on forcing the Prime Minister to step down, does make sense when you look at other countries where people in heads of government, presidents and so on, are on occasions forced to step aside from their role whilst investigations take place. And that was clearly not on the agenda for PNG. It would have been perhaps better if students had focused on the huge issue that really has everybody worried, which is why there is no activity in trying to find out why the money is stolen and where it's gone, and to discover why people aren't being held accountable for this. However, the students took it as their right to insist that the Prime Minister move out of that office and present himself to the courts for further investigation. And he disagreed. That created a confrontation, and as a result, we now see the students themselves suffering. That was our fear when it started.
After the shooting by the police down at Waigani, the Prime Minister had said there would be an inquiry. What would you like to see happen about what happened that day?
What happened that day was despicable. unacceptable and wrong and an example of a huge issue that we face, which is that some elements in the police force, and in fact many elements in government, have nil respect for the law and behave as they wish. In that particular case, they nearly killed and most certainly seriously injured students. And from the descriptions we've had, it was not accidental. It was a deliberate breach of the law. It's important that everybody see and hear what happened.
A former Secretary of Justice in Nauru, David Lamborn, says passports cannot be withdrawn on the basis of alleged class conduct. 20 Nauruans who've been accused of involvement in anti-government protests last year have had their passports withdrawn. Among them are three former MPs, including former President Sperend Dadiworo, who is in urgent need of cardiac medical care, which is not available in Nauru. Nauru has yet to announce the reasons for the cancellations, though it is a device. It was used last year to detain MP Rowan Kun for more than 12 months. Mr. Kun escaped from the island using a New Zealand passport after he'd been given New Zealand citizenship. Don Wiseman asked Mr. Lamborn what he thought the Nauru government was trying to achieve.
From a distance, it's difficult to try and grasp the thinking of the responsible minister in this case, Mr. Adiang, but it's not surprising based on the contact I've had previously with the minister and the actions that he's undertaken over the last couple of years. But this is just another blatant abuse of power by Minister Adiang and the Wanga government in Nauru.
Is it legal?
The Passports Act does give the minister the power to cancel the passports of a Nauruan passport holder, but only for prospective concern. So he would have to have concern that at some point in the future, former President Davido was going to pose a security risk to the people and country of Nauru. It's not appropriate for a passport to be cancelled for alleged past conduct. And the powers of the minister, while he does have the power to cancel a passport, he doesn't have the power to do so because of something somebody might have done in the past.
So Sprint Debido has a very good chance then of overturning this in the court.
The problem is, from a legal perspective, is that the court cannot order the minister to grant Sprint his passport. All the court can do, and this is just a basic principle of judicial review, if the court considers that the minister has made the wrong decision or has made a decision that he doesn't have the power to make or a decision that he's made based on irrelevant considerations, all the court can do is send the matter back to the minister to be re-decided. And so the court doesn't have the absolute power to order that Sprint's passport be returned to him.
All right. Now, you are one of a number of lawyers who's been battling for months and months to try and get into the country to represent your clients there. How is that process going now?
Well, we've basically got to the point where we had been holding on to see what the outcome of the elections might have been, to see whether there might have been a change of attitude on the part of the government. The result went the other way, and so we basically conceded that there was little point in persisting with my visa application. So any assistance that I'm providing is now being done from afar rather than with any prospect of me returning to Nauru in the short term.
In terms of the prospects for these politicians and just normal Nauruans who have lost their passports and are facing charges and have lost their jobs and so on because of the actions of the government, how do you rate their immediate prospects in terms of overcoming all of those hurdles?
Well, not good. We saw with the Rowan Kun case that really the only way that matter ended up being resolved was based on an extremely generous act of the New Zealand government in granting him citizenship. But had it not been for that act, Roland would still be stuck in Nauru, separated from his family. The individuals in the current case, they are just being subjected to a clearly authoritarian act on the part of what appears to be an irrational government.
A New Zealand academic says there is a need for Pacific leaders to develop a new approach to regional issues at their summit next month. This comes after the muted reaction from governments in the region to reports that have further revealed the extent of abuse and maltreatment of asylum seekers at the Australian-run camps in Nauru. 2 weeks ago, the Guardian newspaper released more than 2,000 incident reports alleging violence and abuse. It followed research on the island conducted by Amnesty International. Australia and New Zealand have had little to say. No island leader has spoken out, or organizations like the Pacific Islands Forum Secretariat have said nothing. Nauru's government says it is all a left-wing fabrication and implies everyone is happy and content on the island. The head of the Pacific Center at Massey University, Malaka Kolatanamegi, spoke to Don Wiseman about the muted reaction.
It is a peculiar situation. It's actually not Nauru's problem entirely. The other thing is, there hasn't been the perhaps violence, the kind of sort of maybe an uprising or rebellion that would trigger a much stronger response from Nauru's neighbours.
So they need something big and obvious.
Yes. What's happening is that Nauru could argue, look, okay, we've got problems, but it's comparable to what's happening in other Pacific Islands. Nauru could say that unless something really awful happens that would encourage others to take a stand. And the third point is that regional organizations such as the Forum, Pacific Islands Forum and others don't want to be seen to be meddling in what is essentially a national issue for Nauru, and to interfere would not be a good thing. And the Forum has said that it's not willing to take that risk, and quite rightly so. I mean,
well, or is it, though? You may be able to class this as a domestic issue, but there are people who are being traumatised, we know that. There are people who are being beaten, there's no question about that. And do we say that it's an internal matter, which is Australia's defence, it's Nauru's defence as well, but should the rest of the Pacific be supporting that?
Well, I mean, that's part of the reason perhaps why there hasn't been an outcry, because of these uncertain, muddy issues. They're not clear-cut, they're not black and white. I mean, one could say, for example, give the Solomon Islands example, where certain factions within the Solomon Islands had wanted, you know, a regional force to bring peace to the Solomons, but it took the region a very long time to make up its mind. And it established these steps that they would go in by invitation only. So I think that's part of the problem here, why people are not acting, is because actually the path forward is not clear-cut.
So that leaves a job for forum leaders, doesn't it, at their forum next month, to clarify just what the region should do in a circumstance like this.
That's right, and they should, and that's an issue I'm sure they will talk about.
Given their past efforts, they are most likely to gloss over it.
That's right. They will probably tread very, very carefully to the point where nothing gets done. And it's because of the reasons that I've already given. And one thinks about the Fiji coup. A lot of the neighbours didn't want to criticise Fiji. So something has to happen drastically, unfortunately, in Nauru before, I think, its neighbours will set up to act.
If it's a case of Australia effectively abusing Nauru, using its power and clout to turn the island on its head in so many ways, doesn't the rest of the Pacific at some point have to think, well, this could happen to us?
Yes, it's an interesting way of looking at it. I mean, and that's what Prem Bandaranaike has been saying for some time now, that Australia and New Zealand meddle too much in Pacific affairs and they should get out of it. That kind of logic could apply to what Australia is doing in Nauru. But then again, I mean, it's not as if Australia is forcing Nauru at gunpoint to do this.
Except it's a country that was on its knees economically. It needed the money. It saw an opportunity and grabbed it. Yep. So in that sense, Australia did have a gun to their head.
Yes, it was Australia. I mean, it could have been China. It could have been New Zealand. My point is that Nauru was vulnerable anyway, economically and in other ways. So it spilled over into the political arena, and it just so happened, I'm not defending Australia, but I'm saying it could have been someone else. The point is that when a country is like that, such as Nauru, it is vulnerable to these effects from the outside. Phosphate and so forth is virtually non-existent. So it doesn't have many options. And so, like many other Pacific Islands that are grabbing at anything that they can find as an income earner for them, regardless of whether it's tax havens or money laundering and so on, there's no choice. There are not many options that Nauru can look at.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. National protection measures are not enough to protect critically endangered hawksbill sea turtle populations in the Pacific. That's one of the main findings from a satellite-tagged exercise of turtles from the South Pacific's largest rookery in Solomon's Avraman Islands. The National Conservancy Melanesian Program Director Richard Hamilton spoke to Karori Hawkins about the exercise.
So I guess when we tagged the turtles, there was several things we really wanted to establish. First of all, we wanted to know whether or not the critically endangered hawksbill turtles, when they're nesting in the Arnavons and the Solomon Islands, whether or not they stayed within the protected area the whole time, because any one turtle will nest 5 to 6 times in one season, and there's about a 2-week period between each successive nesting event. So we really wanted to know if the protected areas were sufficient. And then, of course, the other really interesting point was to get an idea of where these turtles returned to once they'd finished nesting, so their migration routes back to their feeding or foraging grounds.
And did they spend enough time in the protected areas?
Yeah, actually they did. I mean, that was a really positive outcome of the research. Probably about, all the turtles summarised together spent about 95% of their time within the protected areas boundary. So that was a really positive finding, and I think really demonstrates that if we can get poaching totally under control in that Arnavons group, then the numbers should continue to improve.
So you said you're tracking their migratory routes. How far are they travelling?
Well, that was another surprising finding. We had 8 turtles which survived. 2 were killed by poachers. Of the 8 that survived, 7 of them had migrated back to the Torres Straits and the southern and northern Great Barrier Reef. So travelling over distances of over 2,000 kilometres in 6 to 7 weeks. So really large distances. And in some ways that sort of explains the very long remigration period we have in the Arnavons. Most of these turtles probably won't return to nest again for another 5 to 7 years, and they're probably fattening up before they make that long journey back to the Arnavons for another nesting season.
You mentioned poaching there. Is that a big problem? And where are the markets for that?
Poaching has, it sort of simmers on and off. It's become a bit of a problem more so than recently in recent years, and we believe that's probably been driven by a growing demand for illegally purchased hawksbill products, probably mainly out of mainland China. So there's buyers in Honiara now which are paying reasonable prices for this hawksbill shell, which then we think is probably being re-exported out of the country. And there's also a smaller trade, I think, in the production of local items like bracelets and hair clips, etc., which are sold to tourists in that trade.
So in terms of the marine protected area size, are they being patrolled? Is that something that needs to be lifted? Or
they are being patrolled. There are rangers based there permanently, but in the past they've all been based at one island known as Kerihikapa, which historically had the highest number of nesting, but now most of the nesting is happening at Sikapo. So one of the things we're in the process of doing is building another ranger station at Sikapo. And since April, there's been rangers based on Sikapo, but they're essentially camping under a piece of canvas. It's not really suitable going forward.
So looking at again at their migratory routes, they're spending most of their adult life in the Australian waters. Is that right?
Yeah. So a lot of these turtles, they're born in the Arnavons, in the Solomons, between Izzl and Choiseul Province. They'll spend about 5 years floating around in the open ocean, which they often refer to as the lost years. And then when they're 5 or 7, they'll settle, they call it, onto a reef where they then spend a large proportion of their time feeding. And then, when they're hitting sexual maturity, about 30 to 35 years of age, they will swim back to their natal beaches where they were born and then breed and nest. So yeah, a lot of the turtles, what we've seen, about 88% of them, born in the Solomons, but spending, probably 90-95% of their life actually in Australian waters. And I guess that's an interesting component of the story, is that what we're seeing here is recovery in the Arnavons, which we documented last year, because they're moving from protected area to protected area, essentially.
Right, and they're spending all that time in Australian waters. Must be good for them as well, being more protected and probably less poaching, would there be, in Australia?
Well, certainly in large areas of the Great Barrier Reef, yeah, for sure. I know there's a traditional take in some places in the Torres Straits, but certainly. And I think what we're seeing in more regionally is that although the nesting hawksbill populations in Australia are highly protected, they do appear to be in decline, and that's probably because of the reverse picture, whereby you have turtles which are nesting in the Great Barrier Reef and highly protected, but they are spending most of their life feeding in Melanesian waters, which are subjected to quite heavy hunting pressure.
Right. So from the whole exercise, what are some of your recommendations, or what are you drawing from your findings?
Well, I guess there's several. I mean, and you know, turtles certainly sort of play to the need to manage at local, national, and regional scales. At the national scale, I think the information's been very valuable. It's shown the need in the Arnavons protected area to increase enforcement and have a permanent local community ranger presence on Sukapo Island, which is now also a very important nesting beach. It's also shown that the current protected areas are sufficient, and I think that's an interesting point. And the Arnavons is also an area which is going towards becoming the first protected area under the Solomon Islands Protected Areas Act. So that's all really, really positive. In terms of the migration, I guess it really just highlights the difficulties in managing these highly migratory shared resources. So a lot of these turtles are migrating out of the Solomons and then passing through Papua New Guinea and then dropping down into Australia. So it really does sort of highlight the need to have some sort of regional agreements and regional management measures which aren't just site-based for these species.
The founder of a new airline plans to start crossing the ditch between Samoa and American Samoa this week. Tofa Airlines will initially fly six times a day, going to head-to-head with Polynesian Airlines, the only other current carrier servicing the route. But the owner of the airline and chief executive, Jeffrey Hunter, is already looking to spread its wings further, with flights to Tongo, Niue on the horizons. He spoke to Joe O'Brien.
It's something I always wanted to do, and then I found the opportunity to do it, and it came to reality now. Another reason is we need a second airline to help with the inconvenience with one airline flying around this area here if their airplanes, you know, are not operating. For any defect reasons, then the people are stranded. So it's always good to have two airlines. If one is down, the other one is picking up the stranded passengers. I mean, that's what we do. We take people from A to B, and you don't really want them stranded at one place. It'll cost them.
So are there problems with the existing services, would you say?
Well, it can be when they're overloaded. Airplanes do have limitations, and when they're tired, they will let you know.
So you believe there's enough business for both of you?
There is enough business for two airlines. My airplane is tiny. It's only a 9-seater airplane. I'm new in the business. I'm about to find out.
It's quite a risky gamble you're taking then.
Everything is a risk. If you don't do it, you'll never find out.
I imagine it's quite a big financial investment getting an airline off the ground, though.
Yeah, airplanes, they're expensive. It was quite a significant undertaking, but I know it'll work. Like I said, the current airline Polynesian that's operating now, there are times that they struggle with the demand.
And we'd been reading about some criticism of their flights, of long delays and that kind of thing. Do you think that could play in your favour?
I don't want to criticise my opposition. All I can say is it's good to have extra capacity so that we can support and try and get rid of the inconvenience of the travelling public.
And will your service be any different?
Well, the only difference is the speed, the comfort that we will provide. The airplane speed is twice faster than what Polynesian is using, and it's our airplanes are air-conditioned. 9-seat is comfortable. You won't have to sit next to the other person because it's a single seat. Yeah, and we will also be providing service to Tonga. We're waiting for a permit from the Tongan government, hoping to start that service before the end of the year. You know, I also want to help out the Tongan people because for them to go from here to Tonga, from Pango and from Apia to Tonga, they had to either travel to Fiji or travel to New Zealand to get back to Tonga. The Niue flight that I'm also looking at, that will be next year.
But are there other airlines currently flying between Samoa and Tonga?
No. It stopped in 2009. The flights between the neighbouring islands is like a love-hate relationship. It's on, off, on, off. I've done these routes in the past 20 years, and it's really tough for the island nation with this kind of on-off service.
DNA experts are investigating a collection of 18th century pigtails believed to be from the Bounty mutineers who set it in Pitcairne Island in the 1700s. Scientists hope they are able to extract DNA from their hair to match them to living descendants of the crewmen. The U.S.-based Pitcairne Island Studies Center was gifted with the pigtails 2 years ago after they were brought bought at auction, that is, in the year 2000. The director of the center, Herbert Ford, told Sally Round, "The strands for the pigtails have been sent to King's College London for testing, but the whole process could take years."
"We have sent a few strands of each pigtail of hair, gathered from the very center of the pigtail of hair, individually packaged in a special envelope to King's College. Then, of course, once they have done this DNA testing, then we'll go to another test, a maternal genealogical test, that will be much more difficult and will be confined only to the feminine side of descendancy. We'll start with the mother of one of the mutineers we know was on Pitcairn Island and see if she had any daughters. If she did, then did that daughter have any daughters? And on down and down and down until a presently living female descendant. If somewhere along the way that daughter did not have any daughters, then of course that study in that line stops completely. So you can see it's a rather difficult task that we have.
And could take several years.
It could take several years, that's true. The DNA initial testing will probably go much quicker, but it probably will only tell us whether or not these pigtails are from European people or Polynesian people.
And given that you've studied this extensively, the story of the mutineers, why would these pigtails have been chopped off and put together? I've seen the photo of them. They're sort of linked on a bit of twine.
Well, in that day and time, the cutting of pigtails of hair and giving them to or keeping them by different people was kind of a term of endearment. And it was not unusual at all. In this particular case, a young lady, Polynesian in character, named Sarah, the daughter of William McCoy, but one of the mutineers, but she was not his own daughter. She was the daughter of his Polynesian consort wife and of a Polynesian father, fathered before Tio, which is the mother's name, left Polynesia with the mutineers. That's kind of complicated, but that's the way it was. And so this young lady then convinced seven of these, according to the written history, seven of these nine mutineers that came to Pitcairn to allow her to cut seven pigtails of their hair, and three of the 12 Polynesian women that came to the island also. She was 10 months old when the mutineers landed on Pitcairn, and she was brought aboard to Pitcairn Island from the ship in a barrel. And so for the time she was the only child on the island, she was quite a special feature of Pitcairn Island.
Can you explain why this need to get some sort of proof of the identity of the mutineers? Because there are descendants, aren't there, on Pitcairn? They've got the surnames of these men.
Yes, and on Norfolk Island too. But this is kind of like mountaineers. There's a mountain there, and why do we make such trouble to climb this mountain? Well, simply because it's there. But in our case, we have specialized in accuracy. We have determined that we are not going to give any information about the bounty saga, as we call it, to people from all over the world who contact us that we have any reason to believe is not the truth.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Our email, of course, is focus@pcjmedia.com. We'll see you again very soon. I'm Keith Powell. Bye for now.